we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to the first ever episode of How Does It Make Sense? A podcast putting together to understand the local rationality, how it makes sense for people to do what they did, which in hindsight, we as external observers might think is just really irrational, but actually it makes total sense. And to kick that off, I've got a friend of mine, Jason Coyle, who is an assistant fire chief, incident commander in the fire space. Jason, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll go into the story that we want to discuss, or one of the first two stories.
Perfect. Thanks, Gareth. So, yeah, I work for the Sedona Fire District. Been there for about 26 years and currently the assistant chief. I also respond to incidents as an operations section chief on one of the national incident management teams. Been doing that for about 22 years. All in all, I have about 3 years deployed, almost 100 different incidents. So I've been out of quite a few different incidents, primarily wildfires. Mm-hmm. And you know, I decided a few years ago, actually right after the Yarnell Hills fire, that I was going to go back to school. And I had a master's in leadership, decided to go back, and I'm pursuing a doctorate in performance psychology. But it's that decision-making in complex environments, especially, you know, with high uncertainty and ambiguity, that are of most interest to me.
Excellent. Yeah. And actually, you know, a lot of the decision-making science, the original sort of naturalistic decision-making and recognition prime decision-making comes from the wildland firefighting community. So I'm sure there's a whole bunch of that distilled down into your space. So one of the things I want to try and get across to people is the complexity of adverse events. And we talk about these ideas called first stories. And invariably, these are the stories that get released in terms of the media or social media. And these are the ones that people make their initial judgments on. And it's really easy to step into the wrong space. So tell us a first story that we want to explore a little bit now, Jason.
You know, one of the ones that I actually use quite a bit when I'm teaching is about elk hunting. So when you're archery elk hunting, you don't blame the elk for being too smart to not go where you need them to go and to give you the opportunity to harvest them. That's just the elk being the elk. But so many times when somebody else is doing something that's in their best interest, we look at it and go, hey, you know, why didn't they do this? Because we're looking at it from the perspective of either what would benefit us or assuming they have all the knowledge we have right now. And, you know, one of them when it comes to wildfires is the lack of personnel in the areas outside of operations. So operations space, most of us have fire day jobs. So, you know, when we go out of fire, it's kind of an extension of our regular work and we can plan around it and we can anticipate it, but we can't do it alone. And we're dependent on people that run our logistics, you know, our finance, our planning. And oftentimes they have jobs that aren't in the fire space and they have bosses and they have commitments that they have to meet and their boss has, you know, targets that they have to make. And so from you know, Jason's perspective, when we can't get an adequate number of personnel to fill those different roles, it's like, don't those people understand that we need XYZ to be successful? But you know, you take a minute, you look at it from the boss's perspective, right? And he's like, I got these deadlines. Fire's not my gig. Why would I let my person go out there and my key player, because that's usually who they are, go out to be a logistics chief on some large incident and lose their ability to help me meet my deadlines for 3 weeks? It doesn't make any sense, but my narrative is it's really easy to just jump right on that.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we'd like you to release one of your staff. How long for? We don't know. And so there's uncertainty on the part of that company as well is, well, we might be able to release them for a couple of days, but actually, from your side, I'm guessing you don't want people for a couple of days. It's either all or nothing. Because if it's a little bit, then they leave a little bit of a job and then somebody has to play pickup.
Yeah, it takes a while. It takes a commitment to get up to those levels where you can you manage the whole incident. Like logistics, there's six or seven different units, from the facilities to the ground support to the food unit. There's all this different stuff, and they have to know all those jobs. So it takes them a while to get to get skilled in those different areas to be able to advance. And so and it just takes one time, 1 or 2 years where their boss doesn't let them, and we lose that capability. It's a certainly is an imperfect system, especially with all the different demands that people face right now.
Totally. And what I find really interesting here is that you've brought up something that's definitely not in the sharp end of wildland firefighting. Now, people, what I thought you're going to talk about was a story where guys have gone out and they're trying to fight a fire, something's gone wrong, somebody's been injured, or equipment's been damaged. The sort of stuff that people think is the risky, difficult stuff. But actually, it's the back end stuff that keeps a lot of this stuff going, these operations running, and that whole piece of, an army marches on its stomach. But if you can't get the back end sorted, you don't have the logistics tail to make the sharp end work. So it's a really, so can you think of, a story where it actually has been, what's the constraint? So if you don't have somebody, what's the impact for those frontline operators? Because I think, Joe Public has got no idea of actually what's involved in a log's tail to make sure that the sharp end works.
No, that's you're absolutely right. I think everybody thinks we're all, throwing dirt and spraying water. But there's a plans one and a logistics one. The plans one is probably the most, I don't know, it's a passive failure that you come to just take it for granted until it's not there. And that's having a solid GIS support that knows how to make good maps. Because they don't, they're just not just making one good map. Fire's moving. We're asking them to add different things to it, the values we call it. But as it gets closer to structures, different things to help us with our decision making and with maintaining a common operating picture. And when you have someone that's really excellent at it just, you ask them, things show up, and we get them on our iPads, load them up on a Venza, get a helicopter, know exactly where you're at. It all makes sense. But boy, when it's gone, and you start getting maps that aren't working, or they're behind where you need the maps. So that's one of the ways that it slows down. It slows down our communication. Because if we're trying to orient off of a map that doesn't have all the features on it, communicate with somebody over radio. And so it just slows things down. The logistics part, I think that one of the ones that's probably easiest to relate is, as these large fires grow, we have our incident command posts, we have where we're operating out of, and sometimes where we're actually working can be 2+ hours away.
Wow.
So we want to set up what we call a spike camp. But that means that we need to have drivers to bring food there. We need to have people to manage that spike camp. It increases the logistical burden significantly. So if we don't have the resources to support those logistical needs, we may choose not to create a spike camp, and it transfers risk to the personnel by driving further every day. They're able to get less work done. Da-dee-da. There's a bunch of stuff that comes downhill of that. And it's all because we can't set up a base camp, or we don't have the resource because there's not enough in the system to get us a caterer or whatever else it is we may need.
That's a really interesting piece. So the first off of the GIS, the mapping guys, is really interesting. That bit about having a shared mental picture within the team, understand who's doing what where and what the threats are. And one of the really cool tools that both you and I use, Interlab, there's another sort of strategic framework for that, which is about discovery of Nexus. And the guys have actually built a time delay in, and they've used a ticker tape system whereby the mission command, mission control, is sending information down to the lower level teams. And if the lower level teams don't report back up with that system change, what's happening on the planet, then flawed decisions are being made. So I can imagine that there's situations where you might end up tasking a sharp end fire team, to go off and do something, and actually it's outdated information, which which upsets, pisses people off, because like, we already done that. And so then trying to get that sort of that cadence going to say, how do we update this? And the problems in that space. So examples of that?
Yes, and I think so. Rapid trust building basically is what needs to occur between the incident management team and whoever we're working for. So we go to somebody else's ground that they're responsible for, and we are delegated responsibility to take over these incidents when they don't have the capacity to do so. So the team, at least our team, has been together for quite a while. It's a cohesive team, but now you have to, build trust with that person that you're working for. And so you look at alternative courses of action, you agree on one, and you move forward. And then there's something that happens in the field that causes them to have to pivot. And if you don't know that, even if you've allowed them the decision space and the autonomy to make that decision without you, if your information is delayed enough, getting back around and say they see a big column now where you said we weren't going to do any burning today, and there's this huge column. You do a few of those things, and next thing you know, you've eroded trust with that person that you haven't really built trust with yet. And then they shorten their leash and they're dissatisfied with what's going on. And then all of a sudden, that becomes the issue instead of the problem you're there to solve.
Really interesting piece there of just how you, because you talk about bits there of who you work for. So you've got a tasking organization above, but do you have subordinate teams that you sort of start to develop and work with as well? So there's trust both up and down that needs to be developed.
There is. And as a matter of fact, one of the places where I had a definite blind spot was we have a certain way in these three meetings a day that we expect people to brief out. And we have of the two levels subordinate to me, they're called division supervisors, but they're responsible for a section of ground. And some we bring with us that are part of our team, but oftentimes we need to pull them from the broader system, and you just place a request for division supervisor and you get whoever you get. Well, bringing that up to speed on that, on how we do our reporting, we weren't doing a good job of it. And so we made videos and then put them on YouTube and then have a LinkedIn link that we give them and say, hey, this is our reporting structure. And here's a couple little tools to help you with that. Because that's the same thing, right? If they don't feel like they're part of the team, or they're worried about that they don't know how to report and they're not focusing on the information they're providing, it's not going to be as good. It's not going to be as useful for us being able to maintain that common operating picture. So just telling people this is how we report out, that doesn't really help unless you give them the framework and some tools, and then give them a good and bad example of how it works. And then it makes things a lot better and the communication improves.
And I think that's one of the, the things that I've taken away from the wildland firefighting community is they're in sort of real in-depth learning. And then the sort of, I saw something which sort of ties into your logistics piece about these spike camps is this regular sharing of knowledge and not just the simple stories. So there was one that was recently in, and where it came up sort of triggered is this spike camp of somebody being run over in the middle of the night where they pitched. And so, a vehicle arrived. There wasn't any, but when people arrived to pitch, there wasn't any sort of real space. So they just pitched down on the ground. And then a vehicle came in trying to find out where to park. There's no markings because of whatever reasons, and unfortunately ran over this guy's legs. And it would be quite easy just to turn around and go, oh, be more careful, pay more attention, only sleep in the right space. And then you realize that actually there's a whole backstory behind this that actually people don't know where to go because you arrive, it's late at night, there isn't anybody around. You're just trying to find somewhere to crash out, not realizing that there's a vehicle going to be coming in. So I think there's, can you tell us about how you, as the fire community, have moved from those first stories to second stories?
In fits and starts, I think is the best way to say it. So, I am continually impressed when I go out with another team. We're a pretty small community, so somebody may need help, and I'll go out with their team on how many new things I learn every time that happens. But one of the challenges that we face is that the requirements, If you look at the task books and what it is that we have to do to fill those positions and what we really have to be capable of, and then what an incident management team is supposed to be able to do, and the expectations that these units we work for have, there's some major gaps, and we've filled those gaps through experiential learning primarily. And so it works when you have enough time to get the experience. What's happened lately is we've gotten more turnover and issues with budgets, things like that, and there's fewer people to go out, is we're turning over those leaders and trying to build them quicker. And that's where you start to see the gaps that we just filled with that tacit knowledge transfer and information. It's you realize that, wow, a lot of times we're being successful despite the system, not because of the system.
Oh, totally. I taught a class last week to a media company doing a lot of overseas natural history shoots. And one of the key takeaways from them was this phrase you talk about, were you lucky or were you good? And it's a difficult question to get posed, or it's an easy question to pose. Were you lucky or were you good? And it's really easy to dismiss it and go, yeah, we were good. Right, why were you good? What can you do to replicate the next time you're in a similar situation? And I think, the fact when we get really experienced people, they don't realize what they've got, that deep tacit knowledge that's really hard to explore and explain to somebody else until you encounter that scenario. There's a one of my sort of favorite quotes from Dave Snowden talking about we always know more than we can say, and we can say more than we can write down. And many organizations use written knowledge, written documents as a way of transferring that, be that SOPs or checklists or processes, and this is what we do. And that's that worker's imagined piece or worker's prescribed. And then in reality, the experienced hands pick it up and go, yeah, I get what the intent is. This is what the goals are, and this is how I'm going to achieve it. But the novices, those journeymen who are watching, don't actually see. Because they can't, because it's an internal thought process, they don't understand what's going on there. So, can you talk to us about that? How do you, as in the olden days when you had a few more people around, as opposed to just banging job to job, how do you explore that tacit knowledge so that people can live the second story?
Yeah, that's a great question. So on the last few incidents, we had a really sharp person that was training under me as an operations section chief. And there had to be at least a half dozen times where I realized that, I told him to write a demobilization plan. And so a demobilization plan is as we get the resources and stuff, as we get the incident, corralled, if you will. And then we start sending people off so they can go someplace else or go home. Then, how do we do that? Well, as an ops person, it's the first thing you do is you're like, okay, what do I need to continue doing the tasks that I have out in the field? And the lesson I learned once and was that you have to consider what everybody else can handle, because the finance section is going to get all these people. And I sent them five times more than they could on an incident. It was, I don't know, 15 years ago. And so that was the key piece of information to give this person. It wasn't that this is the process, but in that demobilization plan, how much can the other functions that have to support that process, how much can they handle? Because right now, those person, they're excess to us, but we're not the ones doing the work. It's somebody else doing the work. And just right now, the process doesn't get you there. You have to explain to people, and it varies, right? Because it depends on how many, if you have a really fully staffed finance section, they may be able to do more. If you
Oh, I'm going to
don't,
be naive here and ask that curious question. So, what does the finance section do when you demob? Is that basically pay people for doing their firefighting?
pay people, close out contracts, and so there's a lot of contract resources that we use, heavy equipment, things like that. So they each have their own contract, and that all has to be closed out. And I actually don't know how many they can do at once, because I've learned to ask them, what do they think is a good, rate? What can they can sustain? But if you don't, and you say like I did, where I sent them 50 or 100 pieces of equipment in one day, and they could, maybe handle 20 or 30, is now those people are waiting in line and not getting anything done, and they're probably blaming the finance section because they're slow. And when in reality, it was the knucklehead ops chief that just deliberately overwhelmed, or not deliberately, but
Well,
overwhelmed
that would
them.
be the first story. Bloody hell, ops guys, don't they have an idea? And so you'll have the narratives being told from the finance team towards you as ops going, incompetence, what's going on? You've got
Totally.
those contractors who are sitting there, and it's managing expectations. You turn around to those contractors and say, right, it's going to take you 5 days to clear who's the priority, who needs to go somewhere else. And so you're trying to manage those multiple pieces of information in those stories. But yeah, you can't easily give an answer. There's a template that says this is what you do, but how you execute it is the difficult piece.
And one more thing to add on that is that on this last incident, we had a someone came into our finance section that wasn't from our team, and for a while she's running the show. And I went and asked her. I said, "Hey, how many pieces of equipment do you think you can manage a day? Because we're getting ready to start a demo because we got around the fire." And she thought about it for a while, gave me a number, and then later on she came back to me. And she goes, "You know, that's the first time an ops chief has ever asked me that." And she was so thankful, and she'd been doing it a while, you know, and. And I was like, yeah. So back to, go full circle, what you said about the knowledge. I had the knowledge, but it wasn't shared. And I could have given somebody this 15-year-old experience that maybe would have helped more people go ask their finance section. But our system doesn't really do a good job of doing that broadly, at least.
Well, I think a lot of this is because, my perspective of this is when you're operating in a complex dynamic space, in effect, you've got to have apprenticeship models. You can't have training certification models to deal with that because there's just no way that you could deliver all of that stuff in one go. And nobody's going to remember it anyway because it doesn't have context. And to do it in the real world, now it has an additional cognitive cost. So if you take an apprentice on side, you go, cool, you've got two people now, you can do twice the work. And so, well, actually, I can do less than one person's work now because I've got to teach this person about what's going on. So there's mismatch between sort of the workload that's needed. And again, another, oh God, they've got two people. Why can't they do the job? Because actually, they don't have two people involved.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. You do things slow, do them at speed under stress, do them at speed under stress consistently.
Yeah.
And so we add the stress right away, and then we wonder why this new person can't do it at speed under stress consistently, and they've never had the sets and reps to get there.
Yeah.
And,
And unlikely to have had the cognitive capacity to notice what's going on around them as well. So if they're constantly in that full-on stress workload that they're just tunnel focused on the execution, but they don't have the big picture. Hey, you've done that task, therefore you must be competent. So that piece of, okay, can you debrief what you just did? Nope, no idea. So no, it's really, really cool story. So you were also talking about the sort of the next level up. Sort of you were talking about incident management side. You wanted stories of that.
So the I guess to keep it in the same framework, we have not been able to consistently staff the same number of incident management teams nationally that we have before. So those numbers have gone down. The demand for incident management teams has not gone down,
Yeah.
as evidenced by this year. And so one of the ways that we attempted to manage this was that they combined both incident management teams. So it's a type one and type two being those stair steps. Now they're both complex incident management teams. On the surface, if you look at it and say, okay, well, we have more teams that can handle complex incidents. That seems like a win, right? But one of the things, disclaimer, I've been on a type one team for 20 some years, so I have whatever innate type one team bias that has caused me to develop. But I remember when I was on a type two team, on a team that handles less complex incidents, even my success indicators were different. Like you had to get there quick, you had to be more tactical, and you had to deal with things, because they were like rapid, like grass fires, things that were moving more quickly, or things that had more clear solutions. And so if you're wasting time doing strategy, stuff like it's my job, you're just wasting time when you should be out there implementing a solution. And now, take those type two teams and say, you're going to go handle these most complex things. A lot of them have the capacity to do that. I mean, as far as the skills of individual people in there, but it's not something that as a team that they may have done a lot. Now you take them and put them in that environment, and then you say, and then they're like, okay, well, we got to be ready for this. People are going to expecting us to do well because we're all the same now. So then they're saying, well, we don't normally carry an air operations branch director, it's called, but somebody that is tasked with managing all the air operations. We better find one of those to put on our team. We better make sure we come with enough middle operational leadership. So we better plus up there. But we haven't done anything to change the whole system. And we haven't shown them, what it is that's expected of them. There hasn't been any training to get people from this type two to complex. So some of them arrive because they were already operating at a high level. Others maybe struggle, but then they pull on all these resources and create something, some of these positions are already scarce, and they increase the scarcity. So now, there's not enough to go around, and the incident that you show up with may need all that because we still manage the ones that type two teams used to do. So, it's just a broader band of the complexity you manage, and you may show up with stuff you don't need, or you may show up one where you need to add more stuff and there's no more stuff in the system. And so, all that, the attempt to fix something without thinking of all those second and third order effects of it has certainly created some challenges.
And I would thought in a resource constrained environment, both people and skills, it's one of those bits of, hey, if we condense this lot or we, compress it all, then we can do that stuff because now we've got the resources. But actually, it's the interactions, the relationships, the understanding of the problem space that you're in. Those mental models may be very different to what they're doing. So they will go off and go, hey, this is how we do it. And you go, no, maybe not.
Well, and so one of the solutions to the problem I just presented was to pool resources. And so you just have them join the team when whatever team needs them. But that's
Which
you have a
works
team that
if you've got teams that don't need them. So I'm guessing with all the wildfires that are growing, seeing, this side of the pond in the UK looking at some of the horrendous situations, it's not like they're getting any smaller and they're not getting any fewer. So your specialist resources are going to get pulled pillar to post. And then you sit there going, who's the priority?
That's true. And then there's always that dance when you first start working with somebody and you're trying to figure that out, that whole teaming stuff. And so, now you have this pool and you pull all these people in. All right, you've made an incident management team because we have one person in every one of the boxes you're supposed to have. And well, now you've made one group of people that fill all these boxes, but you haven't made a team. And so, it's complicated and it's complex,
Well, we and just an another added dimension which sort of you and I have discussed in the past is public perception of this. So you'll have internal professional perceptions of what's working, what's not, and the gaps. The public sees one of two things. One is it's all going horribly wrong, and why is my building burning down? Or they see the sort of the duck, the serene duck on the surface, who just and underneath it's like flapping away. So what's, how does the public add a dimension? What are your sort of thoughts on that sort of second story of what they perceive? Because I would have thought that they're very much a first story consumer, and why can't you do this stuff? How do you deal with the second stories in the public?
they are. And I think the divorcing decision quality from decision outcomes, especially when it comes to dealing with the public, is really challenging. Me personally, we were on a fire on multiple times over 45 days, and there were multiple incident management teams on the fire. So I got to see how the other operations section chiefs brief their section of the fire versus the way that I did it a number of different times. And one thing that And then read the comments, because you would go on, like a Facebook stream or whatever, and read the comments from the public. And one thing that I believe is true after doing that is that they understand that there's some uncertainty in what we're doing. As long as we explain where the uncertainty is, what we're doing, why we think it's going to be successful, and what we're going to do if it's not successful. But if you say, don't worry, we got this, and then you lose it, which I would see that in these video. you'll never get that trust back, because
Yes.
now they're like, well, they said they had it, so they must have screwed up.
There's an interesting piece of almost that bit of leading with vulnerability of, if you explain that this is an unknown situation, we don't know where it's going, we think it's going this way, and this is the best we've got, then actually that's being vulnerable. And I think that's probably not something that's normal in the US sort of services, either military or paramilitary or fire, is no, we're all really competent people, we know what we're doing, and we have to show that. But actually, that sort of false, I'm going to say false bravado, it's not done from malicious intent. It's this bit of, look, we've got to show that we know what we're doing, when in fact, probably Joe Public's quite happy to hear that we don't know, but we're going to do what we can.
I agree with that. And I'm certain that I used to do that all the time. And I probably still do it some now. And because it's the first way you learn, right? You're expected to be competent in that position. You've been, you went through your training, you went through your apprenticeship, you've been signed off, and now you're out there filling that role. People expect you to be competent. You've come up there and say, I have a plan, but I don't think it's going to work. That's not what they hired you for. So it does. It takes, well, and takes you seeing multiple different things and to feel comfortable talking about what variables could impact the outcome that are beyond your control. And then the big win is then you get to focus on preparing for them. Because until you acknowledge that, then you're like, yep, this is going to work. And then when it doesn't, you're back on your heels and you're, oh, if I give you an example on this
Yeah, go for it, please.
last fire we had, the forecasted winds were 70 plus miles an hour, and they actually materialized. And then our fire modeling showed that under those conditions, if the fire got outside of the perimeter, it could go 7 miles. And it was 7 miles into a heavily populated area, and that had a lot of trees and a lot of houses. And so we bolstered all the resources. We had a bunch of people committed out to line trying to prevent it from going outside of there. But we also built 7 zones and had turning out the power plants, had rally points, had all this kind of stuff if we needed to keep bumping up further into this urban area that the fire would move into. And fortunately, we didn't have to, but it's easy to squander discretionary time when you haven't, when you're so focused on the fact that my plan's going to be successful. Once you accept that if anything gets out, the predictions are this, we need to prepare for that worst prediction. And then you drill into that. You get to take that discretionary time and make yourself a heck of a lot more successful when you don't have discretionary time.
Yeah, that piece of trying to, no pun intended, firefight and do business as usual at the same time means that your sort of cognitive loads within your team or individuals just going to set you up for failure. So, and that must be a really hard thing to sit there and go, hey, we've got this nailed, we've got a bit of time, let's just sit back, as opposed to, and then motivating people within your team to sit there and go, no, just because we think we've got it nailed, we've got X amount of time, we need to maximize the use of that.
Well, that you're absolutely right, Gareth, and that's one of the things when you don't have the personnel that falls off the plate. So, we have a field operations, a planning operations, and then a strategic operations. Field operations, they're the ones on the radio telling people what to do that day, out coordinating all the stuff. Planning ops is that 24 to 72 hour. We'd say they're setting the table, they're making sure that resources stuff are ready so that field ops can continue on the plan. And my job is a strategy. And if you only have two ops chiefs because there's not enough resources, you have somebody doing double duty between planning and strategy. And you don't have the time to explore all those different alternatives. You're too busy. And you're too busy doing the stuff that matters tomorrow to worry about the stuff that matters a week from now. So you're absolutely right. It's easy to see why it doesn't happen when you realize the resource, the demands that are put on those people. In those other two positions, and how they just they can't you can't just okay we're gonna do that too and just and it'd be done the same. It doesn't work.
And how do you prepare people for this? What's the training system? Because invariably it's like, oh, more training needed. But actually, I'm guessing you do have a training system, you have sort of exercises, but what are those like? Or is it basically you train on the job in an apprenticeship model?
With the strategic operations, it's primarily training on the job. And I admit I have to work very hard to get good at training people, because I'll talk about that. We need, talk about critical thinking and how we need to anticipate failures. I'll throw some red teaming tools in there, but I haven't practiced articulating my process to a point you made earlier, and where it starts and what are the priorities and how we address those priorities. Oftentimes shifts during the day, depending on if you need to build more trust with the people that you're working for, or you need to, make sure that the public 3 or 4 days from now is bought into the fact that they may need to evacuate so you can have a timely evacuation. So you're bouncing back and forth between these different things as the situation emerges. And you have to be comfortable with that. You have to be comfortable knowing that you can't follow a checklist. And then you have to get better at, if you're me, helping people learn how to not follow the checklist and to deal with it the way.
Well,
Because
so that brings us into another bit of the judgments that happen is people, we both know about the Kinevin framework, where you're talking about sort of clear and complicated and then complex environments, and the clear and complicated being ordered, and you can use best and good practice, and often checklists and structures can really help you in that space. And that's what people think. Well, why can't you follow a checklist? But you just said that actually, and I agree with you, that it's not possible. So how do you bridge that cognitive gap for people? There's probably a bit of dissonance there where people go, where's the template? How do I do this? What do I need to follow?
Well, there is, and especially when a lot of our stuff follows that. We have this planning P that's a checklist. We have all sorts of different things. We have pre-flight checklists. We have all these different things that, we use all the time. And so tell them, like, hey, I don't want you to define the outcome. I want you to define the next decision point. And what are the choice sets that we maybe deal with? And how do we prepare to be successful if we have to choose one of those options? That's a little checklisty, because
It's
it's
a
knowing
little bit
that
of
you don't
structure with some freedom in it.
yeah it's knowing that you don't know what's going to happen there, and just being comfortable with that. And when you get pushback from people above you, because you brief something out and you say, this is what's going on, and this is when we will make a decision, and this is these are the sources of evidence we're going to use, and this is what would cause us to choose this one over that one when you look at the choice sets. And people are like, well, what are you going to do? Well, we're going to do this. We're going to maintain optionality, basically. But you can't tell people maintain optionality. They'll be like, what does that mean? But so you
I don't
got
know. We'll see what happens.
to, exactly, right? Because you need to maintain trust, because you're, and so you have to convey competence and still and be comfortable with ambiguity and a bunch of different things all at once that, we don't have a training for it. We certainly do not. And
And does that lack of training, I'm guessing you said, a lot of your fighting teams come from within the fire system. You've got a National Fire Training Academy or National Fire Academy. Are you able to feed some of this stuff back in so that you've got thought processes at the grassroots level?
A little bit, yeah. And I mean, I've certainly fed stuff back in. What comes out the other side, still waiting on. But there's been successes. One of the gentlemen that I work with, his name is Todd Miranda. He was the chair of this REMS, rapid extraction module system, this to develop a standard, a national standard. And they did that, I think, in 3 years, and have a national standard. Of course, some people don't like it, but that was a big deal. Because it makes sure that piece of equipment that you use to, and that team that's used to help firefighters when they're injured in difficult terrain, that you could expect a certain thing when one of those teams showed up. So there's successes there, and I have people that work at WCG that are trying really hard. The system has been the same system for a long time, and it's
But
heavily committed.
inertia.
Yeah, it's heavily committed, and so you can imagine how that can delay things. Let's just put it that
Well,
way.
just the fact that you said, it took 3 years to get a standard sorted and deployed. Absolutely. Having been involved in UK military and how long projects take to write the requirements, to get them signed off, to go and get something and test it. And, so absolutely the bureaucracy that's there. And again, that's another second story that's there that people don't realize. It's like, well, you got that kit. Can't you just field it? No. Because if we field it and we're experimenting in a live situation and something goes wrong, you'll all turn around and go, well, weren't you trained on it? No. What do you deploy it for without training then? And so you end up with these situations where sometimes you've just got to get out there and do it. And that's that sort of experimenting that we have. Now
And
we sort of go on.
I was just going to say, without getting too far into that rabbit hole, I hope that there's something that we could all learn from the Ukraine military and then being thrown a bunch of different pieces of equipment and use a lot of them to success without the same level of training that maybe we thought was necessary to be successful with those tools. So.
Oh, I think in times of crisis, especially national crisis, and warfare being one of those, innovation just goes through the roof because there's an awful lot of constraints get removed, and you sit there and go, well, we'll take that as an operational risk. And actually, again, another sort of bureaucracy piece is that you're willing to accept. I'm just thinking of vehicles that we had in Afghanistan that we procured under urgent operational requirements. So we accepted safety levels that were less than we would have back in the UK for operating on the roads or in the ranges that we would have. And so come the end of, and the money was for specific operations. And if you wanted to bring it in core, then the units then, or the defense budget had to find the money for that. And so you get to the end of operations, they go, right, we're going to bring this stuff back. And you go, yeah, it's not roadworthy. Can't use in the UK. What? We're just going to have to scrap it, going to leave it out there. And of course, Joe Public just hears millions of pounds
Yep.
worth of gear left behind. Why aren't we using that? It's like, because it wasn't procured under the normal criteria, because we're willing to accept a greater risk in an operational space.
You're absolutely right.
Pretty
You're right.
sure you'll have similar bits. But, from a warfare point of view, you sit there and go, right, I saw a piece the other day of a fairly major quadcopter UAS, unmanned air system, where they put an RPG on it, and they're basically flying what was what would normally be a soldier mounted or soldier fired rocket or soldier carried rocket propelled grenade, and basically they'd slung it under a drone, and then they fire it, fly it so it's closer to the tank, and then release this thing, and you're like, wow. Okay. The innovation that sits there and goes, right, how do we stop our people getting killed? We'll innovate. And we trial, we error, and we see what happens.
Yeah, and in a less significant way, that's happening around on different incidents all across the United States, and then, but the capturing of it, I think, is a big thing that we miss is how we can capitalize on that. When you're not constrained by the rules to use it further, but it's you're right. People get they get very creative and they get good at making sure that they're going to be successful. Or at least the highest likelihood of them being successful with what they have available. And then, I mean, that functional fixedness happens all the time. And so it goes away once you realize that you don't have all that stuff and you still got to get this done. And if you don't, there's going to be this big consequence. And then all of a sudden you come up with better ideas,
And I think that also again ties into this piece of local rationality and how does it make sense? Because you end up with senior decision makers at the sort of headquarters level who've got no real idea what frontline operations are like, be that military or in the firefighting space. So people will innovate, get stuff done. And then there's that bit of how do I share that knowledge? We've just adapted, broken some rules, achieved a goal, saved some resources, saved some people, and we got ahead of the game. How do we tell somebody? Because if they find out what we did, we're in the shit for that. And it's like, but actually that's again creating that trusting culture that sits there, hey, Jason, this is what we did here to solve this problem. And it's that bit of not jumping up and down going, ah, what? You sit there going, okay, cool. Tell us how it made sense.
And that's one of the things that's been kind of a pet peeve of mine lately is saying, hey, we're just gonna have to learn how to do more with less, or they'll figure it out. That's basically code for, I'm not gonna ask you how you did it. but go ahead and solve the problem. But I want, plausible deniability that I knew that you were operating, or that you were resource constrained this whole time and you haven't had enough stuff to do what you need to do. And fortunately, you figured out another way to do it. But then it shifts the blame to, if it doesn't work out, to those people didn't figure it out. And then it really it takes some of the accountability away from the people that are capable of changing the system.
And before we move into this final piece, was just ties in nicely with a paper, and I can't pronounce the second name, a lady called Leonie. She was a psychologist working for the Dutch Air Force and did a PhD looking at a bunch of human factors issues and decision making. And one of her papers she wrote was talking about the workarounds that and the adaptations that are needed to get work done. And she interviewed different levels within the Dutch Air Force. So frontline operators, middle managers, sort of squadron boss, flight commanders, and then headquarters level. So you go and free to speak to the frontline operators and say, how often do you have to adapt and work around and, get stuff done? And it was just like, all the time. We can't, because we don't have all the resources, we've got constraints. But we know what the what the goals are, and we know where our boundaries are to achieve that. To then speak to the middle management, and their perspective was one eye looking down, going, "Yeah, we know it's there, but we don't ask," and one eye looking up to headquarters, going, "Yeah, everybody's following the rules." And then you go and speak to the headquarters staff, and you go, "Yeah, everybody follows the rules." And so you end up depending on where you are in the system. But I can pretty much guarantee that the middle managers will be adapting and working around. And the senior guys will also be doing the same, but they don't necessarily see it that same perspective. So the final sort of piece on the sort of podcast is something for people to go away and look up or read or watch. So if you were going to sort of recommend a book or a research article or a video about learning about these ideas about how to make sense, this local rationality, what would you recommend and why?
That's a great question. So, learn more about red teaming, learn more about applied critical thinking if you're a leader and you're operating in those spaces. And there's free stuff out there. It's military, it's not proprietary, and there's lots of good tools and applications with that. Liberating structures, same thing. Figure out how to get people to tell you what's really going on. Those will help with that. And then if I had a book, there's a book called Left of Bang, and this book talked about what you do before the event and to make sure that the event doesn't occur. And what caused me to really appreciate it, it's just a little book, but appreciate it, was that they talk about things about lines of drift and then points of repulsion and points of attraction for different things. And it's based on how to look for bad guys, basically. But I use this all the time. I use this on incidents. I use it when I'm elk hunting, because like a watering hole is a point of attraction for the elk. A point of repulsion is an area where people are camping all the time, and so I want to go near them. And so the lines of drift is how they're going to move between there. And so once you start even taking something apart like that and looking at those different, hey, this place where they're making bombs is a point of attraction for the bad guys, but it's going to be a point of repulsion for the people in that community that know that there's bomb making going on there and they want to be away from there. And then you start looking at that, it gets you back down to individual actors are going to act in their own best interest, and they're going to follow a path to get there. And if you start looking for anomalies and start looking for why that might be, I think it helps you improve your decision quality. And I found it to be applicable in a bunch of different ways.
That's really cool. I'll put those in the show notes. And that, as you were talking about, reminds me of Dave Snowden's piece of we want more stories like that and less stories like this. The adjacent possibles that are there. Sit there and we start here in the bottom left and we want to get to the top right. We're never going to be able to get make that big jump. So what are
Totally.
the little islands that we can get to across there? So what I love about this stuff is that, I'm going to be interviewing loads of different people across lots of different domains. And it's all abstractable. I've heard of that book, Left of Bang, before from a police side of things. And you're sitting there going, so what's that got to do with me in high-risk industries? And you're sitting there going, people are people. It's just the stories that change. So, Jason,
Very true.
thank you very much for your time. It's been really cool hearing all about, I'm going to say, the blunt side of the firefighting. You sit there and go, oh, it's all about the scary stuff. The guys are out there hacking trees down and dropping retardant and water. But actually, there's a whole bunch of back-end stuff that if you don't get that sorted, you ain't putting the fires out.
We are highly dependent on and grateful for them, and they don't get enough recognition, but we can't do it without them.
Excellent. Thanks so much for your time, Jason, and we'll catch you soon.
Take care.